History tells us, like it or not, as goes the mill, so goes Weirton, in good times and bad. This is a quote from Dr. David Jabersack, a former professor and local Ohio Valley historian, in his book, History of Weirton. There's a lot of truth in that statement. Weirton would have never existed without the mill. And up until its fateful bankruptcy, the town fully depended on Weirton Steel, like any devoted company town. This episode will trace through some of the highlights of Weirton's history, providing an overview of its prominence and decline. Archival audio for this episode was generously provided by the Weirton Area Museum and Cultural Center. When Ernest Tenner Weir arrived in the Ohio Valley in 1909, he had a larger-than-life vision, a fully integrated steel mill. John Bolzano, the benefits coordinator of United Steelworkers 2911 in Weirton, helped me understand what that meant.
What I mean by a fully integrated steel mill was the way the process of making steel back in the 50s was a gigantic project. First of all, you'd have to have blast furnaces.
The mill in Weirton contained all the steps of the steel making process, from the initial iron making and blast furnaces.
See how it looks real big and tall? Inside this bell right here would be the hot iron cooking and cooking and cooking.
The smelting of steel in open hearths.
Like you're making a pot of soup, you're putting beans and carrots and stuff in it to make steel for what the customer wants. Special ingredients.
To the eventual coiling of steel sheets.
And zoom, run it through this here rolling mill. And that rolling mill just keeps squeezing it and squeezing it and squeezing it until it gets a coil.
It was a massive production that required more than 10,000 workers. Long before the mill existed, a much gentler landscape occupied the space where Weirton is today. All that was there was a small farming village known as Holliday's Cove, named after a colonial fort built in the area in 1776. Located in Hancock County, the northernmost county in West Virginia, the village rested in a beautiful valley nestled between rolling hills, marked with fields and thousands of fruit-bearing trees. There was some industry there, the first being iron-making at the Peter Tar Furnace, built in 1790. But the farmland dominated for at least 100 more years until oil wells began dotting the landscape in the late 1800s. Ernest Tenner Weir bought 105 acres of land there to develop a steel mill in 1909.
In 1909, a man stood on a hilltop, looked down into an Ohio River Valley, and said, "Here we will build a steel plant." Before him, he saw the placid grain fields and apple orchards of Holliday's Cove, West Virginia. One day, years later, he stands on the hilltop and looks down into the valley again. He, Ernest T. Weir, sees many things. Early beginnings, struggles, achievements. He sees a dream come true. He sees Weirton, USA.
Weir might have liked the look and location of the land, but he also liked its relative isolation. He was fervently anti-union, and his managerial style reflected this. A large part of his vision as a CEO was to keep national unions out of his mill. He fostered a paternalistic environment to make this possible. Charles Verano, author of Forced Choices, a book about paternalism and its role in Weirton Steel's eventual worker buyout, described this concept.
Paternalism was a way in which the owners of companies, primarily the robber baron types back at the turn of the century, sought to organize their companies, and in this case organize the mill, in a way that brought elements of a family structure into an otherwise industrial concern.
Weir, acting as the father figure, built up a community entirely dependent on the mill. His workforce constructed the infrastructure and public utilities that tens of thousands of people would rely on. This company town structure faced opposition during the 1919 steel strike, during which the American Federation of Labor, or AFL, attempted to organize the nation's steel industry. As Jabersack notes in his book, steelworkers were disgruntled from working 12-hour shifts and making only $4 a day. But organized labor lost their battle in Weirton, In October 1919, Weir ordered his company police force to round up almost 200 suspected radicals, who were mostly workers from Finland, and march them to Town Square. They were forced to kneel before the American flag, kiss it, and then they were chased out of town. In 1929, Wheaton Steel merged with a few other metal companies to form National Steel, the only steel corporation to keep its head above water during the Great Depression. As President Franklin Roosevelt strengthened unions, Weir continued to douse the flames of organized labor and ultimately maintain Wheaton's reputation as a scab town.
You know, we take care of our own in our own way. And, you know, nobody should come in and tell us how to do it.
This paternalistic environment fostered a devoted Americanism that helped the war effort when the United States military entered World War II. When the battle of production intensified, Wheaton Steel was there to support the front lines.
And the Army wanted more. D-Day was coming fast. So on the 28th of March, 1944...
Wheaton Steel Company. Yes, Colonel Downey. I'll connect you with Mr. Millsop.
That's right. The 8-inch projectile. The M-106. Think you people at Wheaton can make it for us?
Thomas Millsop was the president of Wheaton Steel then. He arranged for the mill to produce 200-pound, 8-inch howitzer shells.
So they were sent to the boys at the fighting front with all possible speed, on fast freight trains, destroyers, and even the air. And the rest, we already know.
Of course, women played a key role during wartime production at Wheaton Steel. The film these sound clips are pulled from show many Rosie the Riveters, all donning headscarves as they work on each step of the production line.
Absenteeism? Take a day off now and then? Ask this lady here on the shell line. She has four sons, four personal reasons for making firepower. She and her three daughters are all in war plants, all fighting the battle of production.
Women returned home after the war, or remained in jobs specifically assigned to female workers. The most prominent of these jobs was called tin flopping. Women at Wheaton wore blue uniforms as they flopped sharp sheets of tin into piles, sorting the metal and looking for defects. It was the highest paying job for women in Wheaton, but still failed to compete with the family wage that men were offered. And, up until 1969, Wheaton Steel had a policy where they wouldn't hire married women. Many women had to leave town to get married or act as if their husbands were only boyfriends. Otherwise, they faced losing their job and the best income available to them in Wheaton. Just 6,693 people lived in Hancock County in 1900. By 1942, more than 13,000 people were working at Wheaton Steel. The mill would continue to employ around 12,000 workers for the next few decades, making it the state's largest employer and taxpayer. Enzo Fracasso, a former steelworker who now serves on the Wheaton City Council, remembers how the mill and the city provide an idyllic setting for a comfortable blue-collar life.
It was fun growing up here in Wheaton, and the mill was always in my everyday life, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, my grandfather worked in the mill, my father worked in the mill, my brother, myself, you know, I mean, we just... The mill made a lot of people, tens of thousands of people, you know, raise a family, send children to school, you know, live the American dream, I guess.
Everyone who's lived in a steel town knows there is a dangerous price to pay for this American dream. 120 people have died in the mill, and their deaths were rarely gentle. Enzo filled me in on some of these tragedies. One time, a man was crushed by a steel coil.
It was something he did every day for 25 years. One day it didn't work. And he paid the ultimate price. From what they told me, they had to shovel him into a bag. A coil with 10, 11 tons that you don't have, you're done. I mean, it's like stepping on a bug. A lot of gruesome stuff that can happen. It has happened.
Regardless of the dangers, the citizens of Wheaton in the Ohio Valley stayed committed to the mill, and the area was seen as an example of the growth and progress of the United States. Unfortunately, it would eventually become a poster child of decline. When other countries rebuilt after World War II and revitalized their manufacturing sectors, they became less dependent on steel from the United States. In 1950, the U.S. produced about half of the world's raw steel. By 1977, it was less than 20%. At the same time, U.S. manufacturers began to capitalize on the cheap foreign steel. As the American steel industry declined, National Steel, Weirton's parent company, started taking profits from Weirton and investing elsewhere. National went from the fourth largest steel company in the country to the fourth largest savings and loans institution. To make matters worse, National started investing in aluminum, despite Weirton Steel being the second largest tin producer in the country. Following the onset of the early 1980s economic recession, on March 2, 1982, National announced they were going to divest completely from their Weirton branch. John Bolzano told me what happened.
National tells Weirton, "We're cutting our ties with you. You're a loser. You have to go. You can either shut it down or your employees can buy it. Called the ESOP. Employee Stock Ownership."
Employee Stock Ownership plans, or ESOPs, were very popular at this time. They offered lucrative tax incentives and gave workers more ownership of their company through stock options that were normally only available to private investors. And ESOPs provided disengaged owners a way to sell their company to already invested employees, as finding an outside buyer might be impossible. It would have cost National $420 to $770 million in shutdown costs and pension liabilities to close up shop. Their best option was to sell Weirton Steel to the workers themselves. Charles Verano illustrated that this was somewhat of a forced choice for the workers.
But it was forced because they were kind of facing, you know, the demise of the town. You know, as I start off the book, the mill goes, so does the town. And that had happened to a lot of places around there. You know, I mean, at that point, all I had to do was look over to Pittsburgh and the Monongahela Valley. And what it looked like was just, you know, shut down plants and people leaving.
To make the deal possible, workers were told their pay would need to be cut by 20%. They also needed to spend $1 billion in the first 10 years of employee ownership on capital investments to upgrade the plant. Weirton Steel employees and citizens banded together to secure their town's future. There were parades and donations from basically every business in town, benefit drives and telethons. The whole town rallied around saving the mill. "We can do it" became the town's new motto, and they would do it. On September 23, 1983, 7,700 workers voted to implement the ESOP. And on January 10, 1984, Weirton Steel Corporation was born. The first 5 years of the ESOP proved profitable. However, Mark Gliptas, president of the USW 2911 in Weirton, thinks these profits only came from special tax incentives given to ESOPs at the time.
They went from losing money or not being viable to all of a sudden making money. They're making money because they had these advantages that the government were giving them, not because they changed the underlying fundamentals of the company to be successful. And you have about 5 years of time to do that. Then if you don't do it, then you'll be losing money again. And we made money the first 5 years before we start losing money again.
Every year, the company laid off more workers, blaming stagnating markets, new EPA regulations that required expensive pollution control updates, free trade policies such as NAFTA, and foreign dumping. In 1998, Weirton was no longer the largest employer in West Virginia. Walmart was. Fewer and fewer employees were called back after each round of layoffs, and the workers took an emotional toll as job security became a thing of the past. Enzo told me he had many friends who took their own lives from the stress of the mill's downfall. One time, while Enzo was cutting grass, a close friend of his randomly dropped by.
You know, we were just talking. He goes, "Hey," he goes, "it was good knowing you." "So what are you talking about, good knowing me? What the hell are you talking about, you know? What do you mean good knowing? I know you. I'll know you tomorrow, too, you know?" And
He goes, well, he goes, you know, it was fun working with you. And I said, okay. I said, well, I'll see you work tomorrow, you know. Didn't think nothing of it. Night he went home. I mean, he was going, because I talked to a few other guys that we worked with. He said he stopped and saw them too, talked to them. And he went home that night, left a note, killed himself. I think that was job related, because he was like really stressed out. I know, I've known a lot of them. I probably, more than I want to know, I can tell you that.
By 1999, just under 5,000 workers remained. Hundreds of those workers and Weirton citizens rallied in Washington, D.C., pushing for protectionist policies for the steel industry. President George W. Bush took the biggest stand for the steel industry 3 years later, when he instated tariffs on steel imports in 2002. Mark Gliptis recalls trying to convince President Bush to continue with the tariffs after a year of their imposition.
I said, Mr. Bush, what are you planning to do on a midterm review of the tariffs on your Fair Trade Act? And he said, we will stay the course. That's a quote from in the White House from Bush. And I said, I'm glad you said that, because we have put together, we the steel industry, 3-year strategies to get us back on our feet. We appreciate you doing the tariffs. Evoking tariffs, that's going to help, but there's 3-year strategies, and it will be devastating if you revoke the tariffs in the midterm review. He goes, I'm going to stay the course. That was Friday. Monday, he revoked them.
Bush called off the tariffs in 2003, and the short-term effort failed to save an industry that had lost hundreds of thousands of jobs since the 1960s. Mark Gliptis placed full blame on the government for the fall of the steel industry in the United States.
And when you went to Washington, and I've been to Washington 50, 60 times, and you walk in the senator's office or a congressman, and they will tell you, what about the economy of Thailand? And what about these foreign countries? What about their economies? They have a right to work. They have a right to make a living. They were so worried about the foreign countries. So, well, what about my people? Okay, well, you have plenty of jobs. I said, no, Walmart's not hiring anymore. Okay. And they deliberately made a systematic decision to shut down the steel industry in this country.
Automation had also been impacting manufacturing employment for many years. A new type of steel mill, called the mini mill, began dominating the steel landscape. Mini mills require far less manpower to operate and produced about half of the steel made in the U.S. in 2002. So, nearly 20 years after the ESOP deal was signed, Weirton Steel filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy on May 19, 2003. The mill officially needed a new buyer, and this time, the employees weren't able to save the business. There was, however, a 2-year-old steel company buying up several bankrupt mills at fire sale prices. This was International Steel Group, or ISG, with Wilbur Ross at the helm. ISG officially bought Weirton Steel for $255 million in 2004, after Weirton Steel had already cut 950 more jobs, handed off its pension liabilities to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, and cut both healthcare and life insurance benefits from its retirees. In 2005, ISG was sold to Middle Steel, and in 2006, after a merger with Arcelor, the Weirton Mill would find its permanent home with ArcelorMittal, the world's largest steelmaker. Which leads us to today. Currently, ArcelorMittal Weirton employs 880 people, a small number compared to the 13,000 who worked there when Weirton Steel was a world competitive powerhouse. I spoke with Tracy Lester Locke, who's been working at the mill for 45 years. She explained that the steel tariffs recently imposed by President Trump have been helping ArcelorMittal, but acknowledged that they aren't a long-term answer.
Right now we're doing okay with the tariffs, but that's only a temporary fix. You know what I mean? That's a temporary fix. Right now it's helping us, you know, but how long is it going to help us? How long are these tariffs going to be in place? You know, and like I said, there is a need for template, but not too many people make template. I think that's why we're still here in spite of ourselves.
Ultimately, though, Tracy believes that the reason the steel industry still exists in Weirton stems from the efforts of the community.
I mean, because in spite of all the turmoil and, you know, shutting down the mill, and, you know, we still persevered. And it just shows what kind of spirit and tenacity that we have as Weirton people. It's just not Weirton steel people, it's Weirton people as a whole.
At this point arises another question. What has all of this meant for the community? We'll take a look at the effects of deindustrialization in the next episode.